From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, I'm Ryan Femuliner. Last November, MU was rocked by protests led by African-American student group Concerned Student 1950. The group of 11 students captured campus attention with its message that university administrators were not doing enough to address racism on campus. One of the group's members began a hunger strike that he said could end one of two ways, with then-UM System President Tim Wolf's resignation or the protesters' death by starvation. The story went national when the MU football team announced a boycott in support of the hunger striker. In quick succession, Tim Wolf resigned. Former MU Chancellor Arbo and Lofton stepped down, and it all unleashed a storm of criticism and debate. How did the University of Missouri get to this point? And how might its path forward navigate the complex landscapes of university funding, policies and staffing, student demands, and Missouri politics? That's what we're exploring in our special three-part series, Mizzou at a Crossroads, from the KBIA Newsroom.
I'm Sarah Shariari. Back in August 2014, Ferguson, Missouri found itself at the center of a national debate about race after white police officer Darren Wilson shot and killed African-American teenager Michael Brown. Less than a year and a half later, that focus shifted about 2 hours west. Once again, Missouri took center stage, this time at the State University's flagship campus. But why Missouri? Missouri is not the biggest or most populous or the richest or the poorest state. As an entire state, it's neither the most urban nor the most rural, the most African American nor the most Caucasian. Likewise, the University of Missouri is none of these things. But if you spend much time looking into the history of Missouri and of the university, you'll find that they were both forged in the fires of a nation deeply divided over race. With its geographic position between North and South, East and West, Missouri stands at a crossroads of policy, migration, and culture. So before we look forward, let's look briefly back.
I mean, it was a huge fight for about a year in Congress trying to determine whether or not Missouri would enter as a slave state. And it was kind of surprising to Southerners, because up until that point, there really hadn't been a whole lot of debate about that at the national level. If, you know, a state wanted to enter as a slave state, nobody really complained about it.
That's historian and UMKC professor Diane Moody Burke.
You know, it was kind of the beginnings of the abolition movement in the North, and there were some Northern congressmen who did not want to see that happen. Sometimes because of, well, some of them, it was for humanitarian reasons, but for a lot of them, it was really for political reasons. They were concerned about the growing power of politicians from the slave states. They didn't want to see, you know, another slave state enter the Union because of that. And so they fought quite hard about it.
Finally, to preserve the balance, Congress came up with the Missouri Compromise in 1820. Missouri then joined the nation as a slave state and Maine as a free state. And the Missouri Compromise determined whether all other new states would be slave or free based on their location on the map. Nineteen years later, the University of Missouri was founded, and the first leaders of the school didn't escape the debate over slavery. Far from it. We're in the art gallery of the State Historical Society of Missouri, with curator of art collections, Joan Stack.
When the University of Missouri is founded, the man they bring
She's looking at a portrait of John Lathrop, the very first president of the University of Missouri.
He was teaching the sorts of things that might encourage students to be anti-slavery. So a group of the curators, kind of pushed by some of the legislators, the conservative element in the legislatures, started going after Lathrop.
Lathrop moved north to become the first chancellor at the University of Wisconsin. Close by is another portrait. It's of the university's second president, James Shannon. Shannon was an outspoken supporter of slavery, a position Stack says probably contributed to tension with the legislature and Shannon leaving the university. It's clear that some early university leaders owned slaves and that wealth associated with slavery helped finance the school. James Sidney Rollins, a lawyer, politician, and slaveholder, is often called the father of MU in part because he helped raise the funds to establish the campus in Columbia. He was in Congress during the Civil War and had originally voted against the 13th Amendment, which would abolish slavery. But later, Missouri abolished slavery at the state level, and a few days after, Rollins gave a rousing speech supporting the 13th Amendment. It's a long speech, and in it, Rollins writes things that at times seem to contradict each other. He writes that he would either support or abolish slavery, whichever maintained national unity. He writes that although slavery is wrong, he believes it ultimately helped people, and he calls himself, quote, an anti-slavery man in sentiment, and yet heretofore a large owner of slaves myself. He also writes that the institution of slavery cannot be defended on moral or religious grounds, and says, quote, I am no longer the owner of a slave, and I thank God for it.
So where did Concerned Student 1950 come from, and what are they fighting for? How are they different, or are they different, from the student movements at MU that have come before them? Well, to explore those questions, I sat down with Howard, who helped co-found the LBC back in the 60s, and with one of the original 11 members of Concerned Student 1950 who followed in Howard's footsteps, to let them have a conversation about their experiences at Mizzou as student activists almost 50 years apart. Meet Marshall Allen, a member of Concerned Student 1950.
Okay, my name is Marshall Allen. I'm a sophomore from Kansas City, Kansas. I'm double majoring in political science and black studies.
Why is it so important that students are involved in change? And specifically, why is it so important that we have students involved here at Mizzou?
Well, the university is there for the students, and they're there to learn. They're there to educate themselves. And from leaving Mizzou, they're going to take what they learn there out into the real world and start practicing those principles. So to make a change there, they're changing themselves as well as the university for the betterment of those that come. You know, I'm glad I was participated in some change in the 60s so that Marshall, you know, for whatever it's worth, he's there, you know.
Yes,
and when he leaves, you know, he's going to leave it to somebody else. So in another 50 years, we won't be talking about the same thing. You know?
Just like Mr. Howard said, it's definitely it's all about the students. Everything that goes on at the university on a university level first directly affects the students. I think that for students who are involved in the various movements on campus, especially regarding black students, it's important to have us involved, because for the majority of the time, it's going to be us that's going to be, I guess, accepted or looked toward to speak on certain issues simply because we have the education.
Does the fact that you guys are, you know, fighting for, working toward the same things encourage you that, like, the movement is continuing, or discourage you that change has been so slow or so non-existent?
It's discouraging to me that it has been, you know, non-existent and so slow to change, or it has changed and regressed. It's in some cases, because there was not a focus on it. And the administration needs to maintain a positive focus going forward to make everything work.
For me, having come after so many pioneers like yourself, Mr. Howard, there comes a sense of cynicism. I come into this, a lot of us come into this knowing that history always repeats itself. So I'm in total agreement. It is very discouraging at times to see that, but at the same time, it's also fuel for us as a means to make sure that we understand that we have to keep doing what we're doing if we want to affect substantial change in the long run.
During the conversation, I also asked Marshall about one piece of the protests from last fall that still puzzles many people. Why did Concerned Student 1950 focus on former UM System President Tim Wolf, when a lot of the animosity on campus last fall had been directed at former MU Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton?
Because it's kind of a bureaucracy. Targeting Tim Wolf was more in line with how we feel and dealt with structural oppression, because it's a top thing. It starts from the top and then it goes down. So if Tim Wolf can remain negligent about the problems of his students and our concerns and what we're asking for and our safety, then that means Chancellor Laughlin is going to feel the same way. He's going to be negligent of our concerns, our safety, and then the administration is going to do the same thing, and then the deans, and then the faculty, and the professors, and then the students eventually. And so the reason why we targeted Tim Wolf, because we knew that we had to make a head change. And we figured that getting him out or making sure that we got him to resign was one of the first steps in making sure that we had change, because if the change starts at the top, then the bottom has to follow.
University of Missouri, Kansas City professor Gary Ebersole says Wolf's first misstep was in 2012, deciding to close the university-operated publishing house, the University of Missouri Press.
He came into the office, looks over budgets, and sees that the university press was in the red. And so he very quickly said, well, we're not going to keep a university press that's in the red, without understanding that there is not a single university press in the country that makes money. In other words, universities subsidize the presses because it's an absolutely essential part of the investment in education that knowledge be distributed and disseminated to the world, really.
It wasn't a bad decision from an economic perspective, but it was missing a certain nuance and deliberation that comes with decision-making in the academic world. Shuttering the Missouri Press would have impacted publishers across the country. And Don Downing says Wolf became aware of that.
There are certain things in the academic world that are different than in the business world. So, yeah, I think Tim would be the first to say that he made some mistakes and learned from those.
Ultimately, Wolf reversed this decision. But critics point to other decisions, too, like the expansion of sports facilities and over-attentiveness to large donors at the expense of academic affairs, the institution's bread and butter.
But to many of the curators, Wolf's biggest misstep may have been the hiring of R. Bowen Lofton as chancellor of the flagship campus in 2013. Here's Wayne Good.
That hire of Bowen and his performance is one of the most disappointing experiences that I've been part of.
Lofton, who previously was president at Texas A&M University, says he was hired by Wolf to shake things up.
The curators and President Wolf both told me I was to be an agent of change.
Lofton moved swiftly as chancellor. He held the position for not even 2 years, but in that time, he rocked the Columbia campus boat.
Under Lofton, 110 faculty and 13 administrators accepted early retirement, reportedly saving the university millions.
That's an extraordinary thing to free up the resources required to renew our faculty in a very short period of time. That's a very rare thing for a campus to be able to do. So I'm very proud this university was able to do that.
But last year, when student aid and benefits ended up on the chopping block, things got sloppy. The university announced it would cut graduate student tuition waivers in half, then reversed the decision.
Another snafu, health insurance subsidies for graduate students were dropped with only a one-day heads up, a decision that Lofton himself reversed.
The damage was done, though. Large student demonstrations popped up on campus in response to these missteps, with many faculty backing them. Here's Wayne Good.
Bowen would grab these situations and go through a process without including a whole lot of people, maybe no one else, and making decisions. And I didn't see that coming.
And there were other high-profile decisions, cutting the vice chancellor for health affairs position, revoking hospital privileges for a Planned Parenthood doctor. Some even attributed the resignation of the dean of the med school to Lofton.
On these three or four problems that he had with medical school, the Planned Parenthood, the others, he just went in and made decisions that he didn't discuss with others, and you can't run a campus that way.
All of these decisions drew backlash from students, from faculty, even administrators, and most of it was directed at Lofton. But Lofton says in every case, he was consulting with Tim Wolf.
Every major decision I made was discussed with him before I made it. So we had a very, very strong relationship, I thought. Back in August of last year, I had my second annual evaluation. September sent me a letter giving me praise for my work and indicating financial rewards along with that.
Tim Wolf did not respond to our multiple requests for an interview, but in a now infamous email published first in the Columbia Daily Tribune in January, Wolf alluded to those decisions made by Lofton, adding that all of the deans of the Missouri campus had called for Lofton's ouster, and that Wolf himself had requested support from the Board of Curators to fire Lofton. Here's David Bradley.
And I'll take some responsibility as a curator. All of the curators, you know, approved it, approved Lowell Lofton on Tim's recommendation.
And this was the environment even before Wolf's confrontation with concerned student 1950 at homecoming. Tension, not just about race, but about university funding, top-down decision-making, all of it part of the struggle to move the university forward into the realities of the 21st century.
Anger and tension brewed in the University of Missouri system. Many students were upset that administrators didn't respond strongly when the student body president was called the N-word off campus in September.
Then, on October 5th, students in the Legion of Black Collegians were called the N-word on campus. Lofton came out strongly, releasing a video condemning the incident.
It's enough. Let's stop this. Let's end hatred and racism at Mizzou.
Emotions boiled over. It was just a few days later that concerned student 1950 stopped Tim Wolf's car at homecoming.
The group issued a list of demands, as Wolf was slow to acknowledge the racial issues even after the homecoming demonstration. One of the demands was for Wolf to be removed as president.
Jonathan Butler began a hunger strike, saying it would only end when Wolf was out as president.
The football team backed the protesters, boycotting practice and games until Butler could eat again, until Wolf was gone.
Grad students joined in.
Faculty came out in support.
November 9th, the university system had reached its breaking point.
Just minutes into this morning's Board of Curators meeting, UM System President Tim Wolf approached the podium and immediately announced his resignation.
So, good morning. Thank you for coming today. I am resigning as president of the University of Missouri System today.
The protesters were ecstatic. But as Craig Van Matry explains, the people who hired Wolf were not.
And then when Wolf did the only thing he could do and resigned, then they had this symbolic head on this symbolic stick, and not one thing of any practical value came out of it from there on. Very disappointing all the way around.
For many of the curators who hired Wolf, the issue of racism on the Mizzou campus was exactly that. Here's David Bradley.
To me, that was a campus-level issue. Tim fell on a sword for this issue.
And Wayne Good.
I, for one, wished he wouldn't have resigned. I talked to him about it at the time.
Warren Erdman.
I'm very sorry that happened. But it doesn't change the fact that Tim Wolf was an excellent leader for the University of Missouri system during his presidency.
That started a domino effect of numerous other university leaders leaving or being pushed out. Those that remain now need to figure out, where do they go from here? In the final installment of our series, Mizzou at a Crossroads, KBIA's Ryan Femuliner tells us about the challenges these university leaders face and their plans so far to address the elephant in the room.
Every year around Martin Luther King Day, the city of Columbia holds an event it calls the Columbia Values Diversity Celebration. This year, there are more than 1,000 people here from organizations throughout the city. Community leaders chat with faith leaders from black churches and leaders of other organizations. Kids are here on a field trip. It's a melting pot, and everyone is smiling. Former University of Missouri Chancellor Brady Deaton is one of those smiling faces.
Every year that I come, there's been this very inspiring sense of togetherness, inclusiveness. We're going to tackle these issues together. And I think that it's an earmark of the Columbia community, one of the highlights of the community. I think if we could bottle this and sell it, we would drive Columbia to the top of the heap, which is where I see it anyway.
There's music, an award ceremony, all that. But when we get to the keynote speaker, the tone of the event quickly changes.
Can I testify for a minute? I'm going to. You might as well give it to me. Living in and facing up to the facts of Ferguson is enough to stress you out.
Reverend Starsky Wilson is from St. Louis. He's co-chair of the Ferguson Commission, which was created by Governor Jay Nixon last year in the wake of the unrest in Ferguson, Missouri. He doesn't hesitate to connect the issues there to the issues here.
We all live in Ferguson. When students have to risk their lives by standing in front of the car of one who is called to serve them, when there has to be organized resistance to keep and risking of scholarship to lift the foot of oppression off the necks of those who pay taxes to support the institution that is their call to educate them, we all live in Ferguson.
He's not speaking into a void. 20 feet away is a table full of leaders of the University of Missouri, the interim system president, the provost, and some vice chancellors. Wilson says Dr. Martin Luther King fought for equal access to opportunity in the 50s and 60s. And then in the 80s and 90s, the focus of these kinds of efforts moved to the issue of diversity.
If diversity is about what you can see in the room, inclusion is about who actually gets to speak. Who got to set up the program? Who got to set up the agenda? Who gets listened to?
Now, he says, the focus must be on inclusion and equity.
Equity will have outcomes, and I walk this progression from access to opportunity to diversity to inclusion to equity because equity is required for reconciliation. We can't have equal relationship as long as I'm a second-class citizen. You want reconciliation? Let's get some of this stuff right.
The event runs longer than planned, and afterward, many people stay and visit. The MU leaders, though, head straight for the doors. They're late for meetings in Jefferson City and back on campus. They have a lot of work to do. One of them is Chuck Henson. As a black man, he says the progression Wilson talked about rings true for him. And it's especially relevant to him now. Three of the four steps are right there in Henson's title.
Yes, that is the name of the division, Division of Inclusion, Diversity, and Equity, Vice Chancellor of Inclusion, Diversity, and Equity.
That vice chancellor position was created the same day President Tim Wolf and Chancellor R. Bowen Lofton resigned in November. Henson, an associate dean in the MU Law School, was appointed to the new position on an interim basis the next day.
We are at the point of talking about the truth. We're beginning that conversation.
One of Henson's first tasks was setting up a new mandatory diversity training for incoming students.
Hello. Give your ID. Thanks.
Students start filing into an auditorium in one of the student centers. This is the third and final session. Students just need to attend one. Since it's the spring semester, it's a smaller group, about 60 students. Many of them are transfer or international exchange students. It's clear why the students are here.
I don't know anything about it. I just know I have to go to it.
I signed up. I actually forgot. And like 30 minutes ago, I was like, oh my God, I have to do this. So I like ran here, but
I just assumed that it was what everybody had to do, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. I figured they were doing it to make up because stupid stuff happened. They're trying to make everyone do it now, which I guess is fine, but
that's what I figured. I figured it was just because of last semester.
I think they figure that we need to have a little bit more of an education so we're not ignorant or don't know what's going on in the lives of other students.
Grant Durham is one of the students filing into the auditorium. He's white, from suburban Kansas City. He shows up in a blue dress shirt with a matching blue bow tie.
I don't know much. All I know is that the intentions of this program are to spread like diversity and acceptance and awareness.
Do you think this is worth your time?
I do think it's worth my time because I think it's important for students at the University of Missouri to have a good sense of home here.
And are you familiar with some of the stuff that happened here last semester? And what do you think about what happened here last semester?
I'm not fully educated on the subject, but from what I've heard, I think that it's a little bit ridiculous that people threw such a fit about it. But
what do you mean fit about what?
Wasn't there like some students who thought? Actually, I'm sorry, I don't know enough.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Malcolm Edwards is another student here. He's black, from the city of St. Louis. He's in a red hoodie and brown leather jacket. He sits down a couple rows behind Grant.
Yeah, it's important, yeah.
Why?
Like, some people just don't know, like, what happens, so...
What do you mean by that? What happens?
Like, you know, I could go through something different than you do every day, you know, so... Basically like that... Like, everybody has a different type of story. Something could happen to them. Something may not happen to them. Happens to other people. Who knows?
They both say they have friends of the opposite race and have conversations about race with them.
Someone who's not of my race, it's kind of, I mean, normally when you're talking to someone of the same race, I mean, you don't, like, say bad things about other races, but just, like, kind of in your head, you know, that just to watch out for that and not, like, say something dumb. If it's a joke and, like, you know, but it's not right to say that.
Like, if I talk to somebody of my race, they're, like, more most of the time just, like, when we talk about it, they probably get angry halfway through or something, like something happened to them. And when I talk to somebody from a different race, they just don't see it from, like, our point of view, I guess. It's just, like, they don't see it, so, like, I understand it, though. So, because, you know, like, they haven't seen it, and, like, it doesn't hurt them, so, like, they... I don't want to say they don't care, but, like, they don't care, basically, yeah.
It isn't until I finish talking to them that I notice. Grant and Malcolm are literally both wearing the exact same brown boat shoes.
Excellent. Okay. So,
this mandatory training has been branded as a diversity orientation program. There are 8 professors in the front of the room, all from different disciplines. They're of a variety of races and backgrounds. They open with a loose discussion and try their best to get students to engage.
Very good.
Later, each of the professors gives a short presentation related to their field. Most of them have some relevance to the issues of diversity. One professor talks about people appropriating other cultures, like the example of a fraternity holding a Mexican-themed party where members showed up dressed like lawn care workers. One talks about his research into why Serena Williams makes far less money each year than Maria Sharapova, despite the fact that Williams, a black woman, is a consistently better tennis player than Sharapova, who is white. There's even a section on comic books from English professor Andrew Hoberick.
2014, when Marvel Comics publishes Ms. Marvel and sort of proves that there's a kind of a younger female audience, and it's not the case.
Along the way, the professors all try to engage. Sometimes they get bites, other times it's crickets. The lectures are about race, but mostly informational, occasionally instructional. Education professor Antonio Castro asks students to stretch.
Building your own experiences with diversity. I mean, it's getting involved in student organizations, getting involved in service learning and study abroad opportunities and activities, but most of all, being willing to embrace the possibility to stretch yourself. That means putting yourself in situations that move you to think differently.
Toward the end, a few students share their stories, one about being biracial but not looking it. Another about what it was like to be friends with a gay student in a small town. After about 2 hours, it's done. Malcolm, the black student in boat shoes, was sitting right next to the door, and he's the first student out. Grant, the white student in boat shoes, walks right out behind Malcolm. Neither talk to any other students as they leave. Here's Malcolm.
Like, yeah, I don't think it'll go anywhere from, like, here. It's just, like, they just, you know, trying to get people to understand, I guess, but, like... Like, when you're out in the real world, who knows what's going to happen? So, like, it may not be fixed, but, I mean, who knows? So.
There will be other discussions on campus focused on race this semester. But Grant says he's not sure if he'll have time for those.
I'm pledging a fraternity right now, so I'm pretty busy with that and keeping up with schoolwork. But, I mean, I think it's a good program, and if I had the time and I was open, then yeah, I would.
A handful of students do stay afterward to talk with the professors or with other students. Stephanie Shanahan is the professor who ran the event. She's a professor of ethnomusicology and black studies at MU. She says training isn't the way to think about what they're trying to do here.
That we didn't want to be teaching at them, that we wanted them to know that that this was to be a conversation, so that in that conversation we can get to know each other. So in a lot of ways we were trying to model what many of us do in class.
She says they purposefully chose the title Diversity at Mizzou, A Taste of Things to Come.
Our real hope is that they become intrigued. I keep using the word teased, you know, like we're just teasing them, and we want them to go out there and really explore.
How much can we change?
Tremendous. We all can. We all can. There is room for change on every level, from administration to students, to faculty, to staff. We all don't know everything. We're all growing, and that's what culture is. Culture evolves, and as a culture here, at Mizzou, that's evolving too, and that's a great thing.
Culture doesn't change. Culture evolves. So it's going to take quite some time for some of the things that we all desire to occur. But we're getting started.